Good morning. Welcome to the roundtable for this Monday, the 17th of August. Very nice to have you with us on this Monday morning. I hope you had a beautiful weekend, whatever you did, whether you're working or not working or just around. Hopefully you had a couple nice days. We're back and we have a lot to talk about. We have a wonderful panel to do it with, and let's get started. A reminder to all of you, you can join us. All you have to do is write to us, panel@wamc.org. You can email us, and we would love to hear what you have to say, what's on your mind. We just ask that you keep your email short and to the point and pre-read them and make sense and, you know, all that kind of stuff, the basics. panel@wamc.org. Let us begin by introducing the group to you. WAMC's Alan Chartok is here. Good morning, Alan. How are you?
Good morning, Big Joe. I'm doing good, I suppose. I've been up a very long time now, and that's only my fault.
Well, it's not a fault if you meant to do it, right? I mean, that's...
Well, you know, I mean, my eyes are open at 1:45.
Yeah. Eyes of
and
blue,
so by
quarter
now,
of two.
What'd you say?
Eyes of blue, 1:45.
Yeah. And so by now, you know, it's a rather full day.
And it sure is. Well, we thank you for being here.
And I thank you for having me.
Jennifer Burns is with us. You all been a lecturer in Africana Studies. Good morning, Jennifer. How are you?
Good morning, everyone. I'm great.
Good to have you here, as always. We also welcome Libby Post to the program. Libby, good morning. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm fine.
Everybody happy?
No.
No? Okay.
No, I don't know. Sort of, I think we're going to be in a state of dread for a couple of weeks. But
I think it's about 80-something days.
Yeah, something like that. I think we may be in the 70s now. But yeah, I think it's going to be a long time. Anyway, welcome. Very nice to have you. I should mention that Sarah Rogerson is to join us. We're waiting for her to connect to our app, which has not happened yet. So we are on that. We're going to try to get a hold of Sarah. And as soon as she becomes available, we'll let you know. And we'll get started on that. But so Sarah Rogerson is an Albany Law School professor and director of the Immigration Law Clinic. And we always love having her on the program. And maybe she's listening, and that'll remind her that she has to be on the show now.
I don't think she'd miss it.
No, not intentionally, but we'll try to find her and keep you up to date. All right, let's get started with what's happening in the world. And to who it may concern, Sarah says that her Opal link is invalid. Do we know what that means? Okay. Ooh. All right. Rob is working on it, and we will we'll figure that out. Okay. Sorry to interrupt the program with technical stuff.
That's Rob, our crack engineer.
Rob Chacon, doing the great duty here of trying to get everything, because God knows we don't want an invalid link. So,
oh, no.
No, that can hurt.
Anything but that.
Causes chafing. Let's talk about the post office. Nancy Pelosi is calling House lawmakers back to vote on post office legislation. The post office making a lot of news this weekend for good reason, of course. On Sunday, the House Speaker said she wants to try to prevent Postal Service changes the Democrats fear could make it harder for millions of Americans to cast mail ballots in November. Members will be expected to return to Washington this week. They were expected to be off until after Labor Day. The move comes as Democrats warn that changes implemented by Postmaster General Louis DeJoy, a former Republican National Convention finance chairman, could wreak havoc during the election, in which a record number of people are likely to vote by mail because of concerns about the coronavirus pandemic. The House previously was not scheduled to return until September. Democrats also warned that slowed postal delivery is delaying prescription medicines, mail to veterans, and Social Security checks for the elderly. Alarmingly, across this nation, we see devastating effects of the president's campaign to sabotage the election by manipulating the Postal Service to disenfranchise voters. That from Nancy Pelosi. She wrote that in a letter to her colleagues. She warned that the lives, livelihoods, and the life of our American democracy are under threat. Alan, how true is that statement?
It's very true. And the fact is that we have a situation where The mail is being threatened in order to advance Donald Trump's political ambitions. Why? Because it's clear that he believes that if people can vote by mail, more people will vote.
Right.
And when you say more people will vote, that means more Democrats. Sorry, that's just the way that it works, and he knows it. So he's doing anything to corrupt that post office process. And that is, frankly, as degenerate and as disgusting as anything. When you see that somebody is going to die, that's right, die, because they didn't get their meds on time, and they can't find somebody to fill that prescription, it is beyond belief that any human being could do that in order to further their own ambition. Not one person, but more than one, and that really will be something. Again, yeah, please.
No, I just want to ask you a question that I don't know that any of us can answer with any great, you know, degree of certainty. But do you think that, because I get this impression that he didn't, but do you think that the president had any idea when he started all this nonsense that it would cause this kind of uproar?
Tough question. So very, very hard to get in somebody's mind.
Yeah.
But the answer is yes. Because I think what he likes to do is to cause uproars and to say crazy, nutty things. And this is just another one. But the consequences of this are so great that I've always thought he was an evil man, but I don't know that he's a stupid man. A lot of people think he is. I don't know about that.
No.
Do I think he knew there would be consequences? Look, he watches television. We know that. And all of this stuff has been laid out time and again.
Well, I think, like, wreaking havoc on the election, I think he expected that. But I don't know if he expected the uproar of people showing up at the Postmaster General's house, the taking of all of the pictures of the sorters going in the back of the trucks, the mailboxes that were on flatbeds going down the highway, and then people saying, look, this is the mail I used to get, this is the mail I get now. It's interesting to see.
And yet, Joe, the latest CNN poll shows the gap between Biden and Trump getting closer. So now there's only 5 points difference between the two of them. There was 10 and 11 in recent polls. Now this is clearly going to happen. But the closer it gets, the more his ability to make mischief. And I think that this post office thing is a pretty good example.
Libby Post.
Well, I think that here's the scenario. He likes to create these problems, as Alan says, throw bombs, blah, 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 and then come in as the savior to try and correct the problem. We've seen him do that over and over again. He creates a problem and then he corrects it, or he sees himself as the person who has the solution. The problem is that the solution this time around is not good for him. You know, the other solutions have been sort of benign, but this one isn't good for him. And so it'll be interesting to see. I mean, Mark Meadows was on the talk shows this weekend and saying, his chief of staff, and saying, oh, we're going to make sure everything is okay. But the idea that there was a clip on Facebook in Massachusetts, I think Waltham, Massachusetts, there were 3 or 4 post boxes, you know, mailboxes outside that had been locked. And yeah, the post office was locked, and it was on a Saturday. You know, I mean, they are doing everything they can to destroy this election, and so it's going to be up to all of us to early vote, bring your absentee ballot to a board of elections, because you're allowed to do that. You can drop it off at an early voting site. You can drop it off the day of the vote, or go vote on the day of the vote. And the governor, I know they're talking about doing drop boxes, and my fear is, and this hasn't happened, but my fear is people tampering with the drop boxes. And so, you know, there'd have to be 24-hour surveillance to make sure that doesn't happen. But this is, look, Trump and his cronies make Nixon look like child's play. This has got to be the most coordinated criminal conspiracy in American history within the White House and within the U.S. government. And unfortunately, with a 24/7 news cycle, social media, our inability to be together in a meaningful way because of the pandemic, people are responding to rumor and innuendo, thinking that's fact, and we're no longer a society where people value the truth. So,
Sarah Rogerson, are you there?
Can you hear me?
I can hear you. How are you?
Okay. I'm well. How are
I'm
you
I'm sorry
all?
You had problems, but I'm glad you are here.
I am too. Happy Monday.
Happy Monday to you. Did you hear our discussion?
I heard the tail end of Alan, and I heard Libby's eloquence.
Before we go to the eloquence of Jennifer.
Compared to Alan's non-eloquence.
Before we go to Jennifer's eloquence, what would you like to add to that?
I'm terrified about what we're seeing. I've never in a million years would have imagined this type of a coordinated attack on democracy from the Oval Office. I'm struggling, to be honest. I know that there's going to be a National Day of Action. There were folks in my town in Niskayuna who gathered at the post office yesterday and were actually joined by someone from the Postal Workers Union. It's time. It's time for us to get out and get in the streets and save the election.
It seems that way. Jennifer Burns.
You know, the more I hear about this, what it really reminds me of is, you know, during the times of Jim Crow and segregation, right? State level voting suppression. And we know that through poll taxes and grandfather clauses and literacy tests. And it was, you know, state level because the state's in charge of how the policies or procedures will go in their state for voting. This now is the same thing, but from the federal level, using a federal entity. So it's like upping the game. And it's not just going to affect minorities. It's going to impact white voters everywhere as well. This is not just a simple suppression, like you won't get your vote in. Mm. This is really a policy and a way of thinking and operation that is silencing big pockets of people, not just minorities, but also white people. And they're not seeing that. That's almost like an elevated segregation through using the Postal Service, aside from the fact that people aren't going to get their scripts and their checks and other things that they need to survive. So they'd be distracted, right? You make voting so hard because they need to survive. They need to eat. They need to get their prescriptions. And they'll have to put their attention someplace else. And that's very scary.
Absolutely. Libby, when you think about this of, you know, what do we do now? And Sarah said, obviously, go to the streets. But as far as the action that Nancy Pelosi wants to take, what, if anything, can that accomplish?
Well, I think the more this is in the spotlight in the media on the 7 o'clock news, the national news, the 6:30 news, the more she's out there, the more social media there is about this, the harder it's going to be for them to continue. I think the Board of Governors of the Post Office called for LaJoy's resignation. The American Postal Workers Union, of which my father was a very proud member, because he worked in the post office, has this great meme up, this great graphic up about, you know, slow snow, sleet, rain, hail, fascism. That's not going to stop us either. I think, you know, people just need to continue to speak out, go into the streets if we can. You know, we're not going to see in America what we see in France or in other European countries where there's going to be a day-long strike. I wish that we could manage to do something like that here, but we have to keep the pressure on Mitch McConnell and the Republicans in the Senate. And some of those Republicans in the Senate are starting to cave. Susan Collins is already caving because she's very much in a bullseye, and it's looking like she's going to lose. So the more pressure we keep on those folks, the better off we'll be.
What do you mean cave?
Susan Collins?
She's well known for scratching her head and saying, "Oh, this isn't good," and then sticking with the Republican majority.
Well, this morning, I read this morning that she has raised issues that this, you know, not in, in her usual mealy mouth way, but at least she said it, that she's concerned with the post office. And that, that this kind of activity needs to stop. I mean, from my perspective, I mean, this is a constitutional issue. This is about free speech.
But if Pelosi brings
really
back
free speech,
Libby, if Pelosi brings back the Democrats, and then throws it because it'll pass overwhelmingly because Americans want their post office. It's that simple.
Right.
Throws it to the Senate. Tell me what Mitch McConnell is going to do. And then when you tell me what he's going to do, tell me what she and a few other senators, Republican senators who are in such bad, such a bad predicament are going to do. They'll let a few of them off the hook, as we always say, but most of them will be in the tank and that'll be it.
Can I just add to that question, which is we had a discussion on this program. We only have about a minute, but we had a discussion on this program about a week and a half ago that the Republicans were showing concerns because they were worried about Republicans not voting because so much was being made about mail. So could that also impact the response that you hear from those on the other on the GOP side?
Oh, I'd like to go.
I think.
Go ahead.
No, you go, Alan.
We have a minute. Go ahead, Alan.
Okay, but basically, look, Trump knows what he's doing. He knows what the demographics of the situation are. He knows that the fewer people who vote, the better off he is. It's that simple. And if a few Republicans, I doubt it very much, because the more money you have, the more likely you are to exercise the franchise. And that has always happened, no matter what the difficulties. So, no, I don't think that's really a big problem.
Excellent. Anything you would like to add in that to that, Libby, in 15 seconds?
No.
Excellent.
Let's go to a break.
All right. We'll go to a break as Libby prescribes, and we welcome your letters. Panel@WAMC.org, panel@WAMC.org. We will be right back after this. Playing the music of Julian Bream this morning, master of guitar and lute, died Friday at the age of 87. Our playlist is posted online, wamc.org/roundtable. We welcome your letter, panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org, and you could certainly weigh in on the topics we are discussing. Let us go to some of the letters that we've gotten so far on voting and the post office. Judy said, "I take care of my dad, a veteran, and all of his meds come by mail from the VA. I've noticed this slow mail issue getting worse over the past few months, requiring me to get additional meds from the local pharmacy to supplement when the mail doesn't show up. While voting is a big concern, not getting life-saving medicine for my dad is a huge concern right now. He needs to survive until the election in order to vote."
Isn't that terrible? I mean, honestly, the fact that this president with his nonsense may be causing people to either not get their drugs or even to suffer greatly from it is really beyond anything I've seen.
You know what, though? It's not just the president. It's the people that he has around him, also in the White House. And the people he appoints to different positions or nominates to the different positions that are also willing to cut these deals and to do these things to keep their kickbacks happening or whatever they got going on, because he can't just do it alone. He needs supporters. He needs people in key positions. And we see that, right? Because he fires people all the time, right? The Attorney General of New York City and all those things. So those people have to be held accountable for this too, not just Trump.
Can I respectfully disagree? And I really mean respectfully, because I think everything you say makes so much sense. It is true that they have responsibility, but he picks them. And if he doesn't like them, and if they stray from his prescribed path, he fires them. That we know. So if something goes wrong at WAMC, I know who's going to get held responsible, and so do you. It'll be me. And in the case of the president is the guy who brings them on and who basically gives them their marching orders to make the kind of trouble they're making.
Well, that is true. And that's why, you know, this morning I saw, I think it was in the New York Times, that there's a criminal inquiry, right, that has been posed for the House Judiciary Committee by Hakeem Jeffries and Ted Lieu into this, right? So they're on the subcommittee for terrorism and homeland security and federal crimes to investigate this. And I think that is so very important, because do we see what's happening here as, I don't want to say a terroristic act, but as something that threatens our homeland security, right? That people within our country domestically are not able to have their rights protected.
I would call it domestic terrorism. I really would. Because that's what it is. They're terrorizing people. They're terrorizing people by not being able to get their drugs, not being able to get their Social Security checks, not being able to vote. I mean, this is terror. This is terrorism in a way. It's nobody's getting shot, per se, but people are going to die, and people's lives will be adversely affected.
But to Alan's point, which I have to, if you got rid of the Postmaster General, and you call for his resignation and you get it, well, who's the next person he's going to put in?
Well, that's part of the problem, is it's going to be a constant flow of cronies.
They all
need to be held accountable, right? Every one of them needs to be held accountable, not just Trump. He hires and fires, and we see that, and he'll continue to do that. But people who are willing to get in bed with him for whatever reasons to be able to do this also should be held accountable.
Yeah. I want to go to Joyce's note, who says, good morning, panel. So Nancy Pelosi is calling her members back. Postmaster General is saying they will not make any changes until after the election. That was from Mark Meadows, actually, yesterday. They have already implemented changes and have not said they will reverse them. Best thing to do is vote in person if you can, and you can see that your vote has been counted. Luke writes, Alan is citing the CNN poll from yesterday that shows Biden's lead at 5 points. There's also a Washington Post ABC poll out this morning that has Biden up by 11, safely over 50%. Biden's leads have been remarkably stable since March, and Biden has polled consistently at or above 50%, which Hillary Clinton never achieved. Alan is right, however, that we should take nothing for granted. That CNN poll is a weird one to look at.
Well, I'm a believer in bad news.
Really?
And I always take bad news. I always take bad news. I always take bad news over good news very seriously.
It's one of the polls that obviously is taken going into a convention. This will be anything but a normal convention over the next several days. But showing that Vice President Biden is only up by 5 points with a margin of error, I believe, of 4 points.
Right.
So then we go to Michael's note. He says, I'm worried that a lot of Americans' votes won't count. This might just be enough for Trump to win. At what point do we commit to in-person voting to make sure our votes count?
Well, there are a lot of people who can't. They just can't. A lot of people, for example, in nursing homes, a lot of people in hospitals, a lot of people who are infirmed to some degree and in a wheelchair. There just are a lot of people who can't get out. Now, you have a so-called democracy,
yep,
or Republican democracy, and you say, you go out and vote. And if you can't get to the poll, the heck with you. Come on.
Ron says, I can understand how someone like Trump might attract a 10 or 15% approval rating, but 35 to 40% of the American people approve of this twisted, warped con artist? It is astounding. How do you explain it? Ignorance? Bigotry? Gullibility? Unreal. Oh, I forgot. We've seen it before in the 1930s in Nazi Germany. That from Ron.
I scratch my head all the time on the same question. Really. It just seems unbelievable. Look, I've always felt And I'd love to know what the panel thinks. I've always felt this is all about race. It's all about racism. And 35% of this country believes that white people need to be in charge. And they are scared to death of the coming numbers, which are that black and brown people are in a position to take over the majority in this country. That's what this is all about. That's where those 35% of the people are.
Jennifer?
100% agree. That's exactly it. We've seen this over and over in American history. There's just a constant fear that there will be like black supremacy, or I should say black and brown supremacy will replace white power. And they don't call it white power and they don't want to call it white supremacy, but it's white control of all of the systems. And so that's really what systematic racism is all about, is people saying that right there is happening and has happened for decades. The fear, though, that black and brown people will not make choices or decisions or laws or policies that benefit white people, too, is really what freaks them out. And it's just not true.
Mm. Sarah.
Yeah, there's also a sort of a polite racism that's happening, that's infecting suburbia as well, in the white suburbs with. And this is what Donald Trump more recently was sort of getting at when he was tweeting about affordable housing in the suburbs, right? He's playing on that fear that like your kids are going to go to school with other kids and it's going to bring down their ability to excel. Like your dominance, your generational dominance is going to be threatened by these other people, and the other people are black and brown.
Yeah,
absolutely.
So you can say I'm not racist. I'm just concerned about my child's future, even though it's all built on a house of lies. And it doesn't sound like racism, right? And this is also you see it in other social spaces, right? This concern that like, well, my home values may decrease, right? It's seen as a loss. And what he did was he vectored the racism, the internalized racism, the systemic racism, all the racism that we have accumulated and built and baked into America. And he vectored that with this underdog sense, right? Like, I'm the underdog. I'm going to fight to get what's right for me and my family. And those two things together can make it easy for people to say, well, I'm not racist. I don't see color. I'm just concerned about my individual heritage and my family going into the future. That's American individualism and exceptionalism. It's really fascinating. I wish I will live long enough to see 100 years from now what sociologists are saying about this time. Mm.
Well, it's so true. And it adds into, you know, he adds extra fear into this, too, with immigration policy and his targeting on Mexican immigrants and Mexican Americans. Right. So that's also a part of that kind of, that one's far more explicit when he talks about it. But underlying and through all of it is those dog whistle things that connect to the white suburbs, to white schools, to, you know, policing. That's in there as well. They're all little triggers based on race and xenophobia.
By the way, this has been around since the Civil War. In other words, this is nothing new. This is the residue of a civil war in this country, you know, where slaves were kept and then outlawed, where Jim Crow took hold after the Emancipation Proclamation. We all know that. Nothing has changed. That 35% that is there for Trump, no matter what he does, is constant, and it's constant on the basis of race and race fear.
Libby? I think I'm going to disagree just a little bit,
Sarah,
real
ahead.
Quick, yep. on nothing changing. So what has changed is that we've actually made enough progress where we're talking about, in legitimate mainstream ways, the possibility of things like reparations. And affirmative action has happened since then, right? And the debate over, like, how should we compensate people for this legacy that has been left behind? And that strikes white people as a very direct, a much more direct quote unquote threat to their pile when you start talking about things like that. And I think that has been what's sort of amped up the volume.
Yeah, but Sarah, the issue here is that, you know, reparations is not a popular enough to be happening in this country. Sure, it's suggested and people roll it out every once in a while and talk about it. But it's not likely that we're going to see that, especially as long as that Senate stays in the Republican hands. And I'm not so sure we'll see it after that, because there's plenty there's enough racism to go around among Democrats also. So, you know, I think you're right that those subjects are being discussed, but I don't see them as being on the front doorstep right now.
No, but I'm sorry, go ahead, Sarah.
No, you go ahead, Jennifer.
Well, I was thinking what Sarah was saying was that those are the things that are the most threatening and the kind of hot button issues that as soon as they're brought up kind of shut people down. Right. Whereas these other things are more subtle. And so, you know, people, I think, want to stay away from the reparations talk. And in some ways, I think some people do think that affirmative action was enough reparations. So stop talking about reparations.
Mm. But you do have a Supreme Court. I'm sorry for interrupting, but you do have a Supreme Court with the present composition, which is not exactly in favor of affirmative action.
Right, and the affirmative action battle has been happening since affirmative action began. Right? I mean, the battle against it has been happening since the start. It's not to say that the victories of the civil rights movement haven't brought some change, because they have. Right? I mean, part of it is that we are able to be where we are today with, you know, integration in so many fields and in so many things. But we've been fooled, or we've kind of all liked the happy story that everything was fixed. And what we're finding is that it hasn't been totally fixed. It has shifted. It has unearthed or shined light on different areas where there's still these disparities, and they've built off of decades of disparities, right? And so that's where that uncomfortability is there.
I don't think any of us disagree with that. At least I don't.
Libby, anything you want to add before we go to break?
No. Everybody said what I had to say.
You're being very helpful, I must say, as far as timing goes, Libby. But please, if you have to say something, please say it. We're going to take a break. I'll come right to you. You can think of whatever you want to say when you come back. We'll take a break. When we come back, we'll hear from Libby, and then we'll move on to other subjects as well. We have your letters, panel@wamc.org. We'll be right back. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning, 50 minutes past 9 o'clock, 10 minutes before the hour. Libby.
This has always been about race. After 8 years of Obama being in the White House, and for these folks, it was all about having an uppity black man in the White House, and they didn't like that. They now have their moment in the sun, and Trump, you know, is the sun god, as it were. And yes, there'll always be this racism. I mean, you know, it's as obvious as the KKK, and it's as insidious as All Lives Matter. You know, when people say that, those who don't really understand that dynamic don't understand what's wrong with it. And those of us who do understand that dynamic is saying, yeah, sure, all lives do matter, but that's not what we're talking about. We're talking about black people and systemic racism and what has happened to these folks in our country for the last 400 years.
So let me see if I get this straight.
You know,
let me see if I get this straight, sure. Lib. So when somebody says, in this context, at this time, all lives matter, that's in contrast to Black Lives Matter. That's what you're saying, right? They know what they're doing.
Absolutely. I do think most people do know what they're saying and do know what they're doing. They're diminishing the response. It's, you know, there's been these great things that have been going around on the web. You know, when somebody says, oh, I have breast cancer, do you then go to say, well, everybody's got cancer. You know, there's all kinds of cancer, so your cancer doesn't matter. You know, oh, it's my birthday. Well, everybody has a birthday, so big deal. You know, no, this is the reality of the situation. Black people have been under the thumb of white white majority in this country for a very long time. That majority is shrinking. People, as you said, Alan, are incredibly scared about that, that they're no longer going to be in the majority. And so what happens is you have incidences like George Floyd, like Breonna Taylor, any person of color driving while black. And so, you know, we need to stand up and say, yes, black lives do matter. And no, this is not about all lives. This is about black lives. But this is the racism in our country. And it's always been about race when it comes to Trump. These people could be starving in the street, and someday they will be. And some of them already are starving in Appalachia and in the real rural areas. But they will still vote for this man because it's about race and nothing more.
All right. Let's take a go ahead. Does anybody want to add anything to that before we move on?
I would just say let's keep watching what people say and write about Kamala Harris.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Let us go to some of the letters. Antonia says, not just race, how are poor white women being helped?
What?
Huh? Well, there are lots of programs. I want to put out there that, the United Way has a calculation that's called ALICE that captures the working poor, essentially, and statistics regarding the working poor. And I don't know what the reader is asking vis-a-vis race, but I would say that there are a lot of poor white folks in the Capital District that receive a lot of that receive assistance. Well, and that those numbers are being tracked as well as, numbers for other folks.
I would answer that a little bit differently. There's a difference between income. Income inequality in this country is at a historic high. So you certainly have a right to ask, what about poor women in general? What about poor people in general? And I don't think we should answer it saying, that there are some, not-for-profit programs that help with that. I think, in fact, you got to recognize that there is a huge wealth gap in this country, period.
We go to letters from Greg, who says, you're putting words in Trump supporters' mouths. You need to invite some in your bubble to learn the truth. I don't know exactly what that means. But
I wish he had said what the truth was.
Yeah, I don't know the example of what the mistruth is that we're talking about, but that's all right. Daisy says, I totally agree with all of you, but I would add in one other factor, and that is anti-intellectualism. And unfortunately, the Dems don't do very well combating it. There is a perception that Dems are elitist and look down on the uneducated. And this is why Joe Biden is the perfect candidate for this time. And I never thought I'd hear myself say that.
And this is why Donald Trump talks about the undereducated, his love for the undereducated or for the non-educated. He knows full well what that letter implies and is correct.
Norman says a large number of our military forces vote by mail, concerned about voting by the armed forces. Jana says every day the panel discusses how awful this administration is. What can ordinary citizens do now other than hope for a Democratic victory in November and a smooth transition in January?
Well, there's a great deal that can be done if somebody is on that side. I know a fellow, ex-professor, fellow friend of mine who gets on the phone before the election and calls everybody he knows all over the country, especially in the battleground states. There's always something to do. You can get on a Greyhound and go there and walk from door to door. Look, there are no limits on what one can do besides vote, although half the country, I may remind everybody, doesn't vote.
Yeah.
Well, and I think it makes it a little harder right now, too.
Go ahead, Jennifer.
Right, what people can do because of the pandemic, right? It was easier before to go door to door. It was kind of easier to be able to engage people in different places and do that. But right now, that's really difficult because of the pandemic. So, what you can do is really, I think local. Connect with neighbors, connect with, community leaders, connect with the library, see how you can set up something and encourage people to get out and vote. Keep a record of where the polling places are and make sure that information is being posted somewhere and gotten out. because you can't just all walk into the polling place because one, it might be closed, or two, you can't get
absolutely.
Out of the pandemic.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely, but you could still use your telephone and call people that you know in battleground states. I mean, it could be expensive, but so what? I mean, what's the price of democracy and keeping a democracy going? That's one way to do it. You have a computer, and a lot of people are using computers right now to send messages out to everybody. Look, there's a lot of things you can do. To say the only thing you can do is vote is just wrong. You can vote. Half the people don't do it, and then you can do an awful lot of other things.
Praying,
I
think, is
our... if you can't vote in this election, really make sure you're looking at the future elections when it comes to who's your state representatives, because part of our issues, too, is what's happening and who's controlling the Senate, right? And so if the Senate were to shift into a Democratic, a more Democratic instead of Republican control, that would make a big difference here as well.
Let's go to Wayne, who says, in response to why so many still support Trump, I've been noticing lately there are a lot of folks out there who support the idea that Trump is fulfilling God's plan, and his whole reason for being in the White House is prophecy being fulfilled. I'm not criticizing anyone's religious conviction, but that thinking cannot ever be changed. Unfortunately, some people are okay to allow that to unfold and will do nothing to stop Trump and try to repair things now. Oh, please, Libby, go off on that.
Show up? What do you mean? Show up?
Well, I just know that's a you know, subject that you're well versed in talking about.
I don't know my folk music. I don't know my folk music well enough. But who wrote? Was it Dylan? I don't know, or Phil Oakes, who wrote about God is on our side. You know that the worst people think that God is on their side.
Yeah, this goes back to the truth letter, right? What is the truth? Well, think about from a biblical standpoint, you know, I am the way and the truth and the life. Nobody comes to the Father except through me. Bet you guys didn't know I could quote scripture.
your dad's a pastor, so of course
he is. And
Bob
that's
Dylan,
what they're talking
by the way.
About. That's what they're talking about. I, you know, think about that. The people who believe that Trump is a reincarnation, right?
Yes.
The way, the truth, and the life.
Yeah. And
it's,
I think that there
deeply
was,
disturbing.
And then there's another passage somewhere that says, and they will bow down before a false god and wear his insignia or something upon their heads, and which is exactly what's going on. You know, the MAGA hat. You know, they are bowing down in front of a false god, but they really do think that he is. Some of these people do think that. Some of that leadership of the radical Christian right, the real whack jobs, and I'm not saying all Christians are whack jobs. Let me just say that right now. But the real right wing folks who hate everybody except white people, you know, are saying this over and over and over again. He's a gift from God. And it's because of the racism that's so endemic within their view of Christianity.
Speaking of truth.
Go ahead. All I'm saying is that they ever really knew that Christ was Semitic, right? He was dark skinned. He's not the white angel that's up in all the churches. He's just not. And that would blow their brains out.
Speaking of truth and light, it's time for news with Ray Graff. We'll go there, and then we'll be back, and we'll continue our conversation. Panel@WAMC.org. Panel@WAMC.org. We'll return right after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and our panel discussion. 8 minutes past 10 o'clock. We welcome your letters, panel@WAMC.org, panel@WAMC.org. We have lots of letters. I would like to get to as many as we can before we switch things up and move on to other topics. Carolita checks in and says, you're making assumptions about people's access to technology and ability to make phone calls. I have students at SUNY who didn't have reliable internet access even before the pandemic, and I've seen people on local help grounds who need help paying their cell phone bills a lot lately. I mean, unless you're assuming that only financially secure middle-class people are your listeners.
Hey, I'd like to answer that. I think it's possible that you do what you can. You may write a letter. You may say the stamp costs too much. You may get on the phone if you can. Some people have phone lines that allow them to call anywhere they want. But no, it's things aren't equal, and the writer makes a good point. On the other hand, what do you want to do, sit on your hands?
Tim says, I think you're wrong to call Trump supporters racist. I think very few people who support Trump dislike black people or really care about black people at all. I believe what they fear is...
there you go.
All right. Let me finish. There's still more to come. I believe what they fear is that government is not working for them and that their dollars are getting them less each day. It is this loss that makes them scared. When you call them racist, you lose them. If I were one of these people, I sure wouldn't listen to this roundtable, and I am desperate to get them to the table, aren't you?
We're all racist, by the way.
Right. Thank you.
Go ahead, Libby.
It's also a matter of degree.
Look, every white person in this country has been raised with a certain perspective and a certain set of expectations of what it means to be white. And there are some of us, many of us, who like never look beyond those expectations and privileges. And then there are many of us who do. But the fact that he said, I think it was a he, specifically, that they don't care about black people is... in itself, racism. Okay, so there's that. But the other thing is that they might not be active racists, but they're supporting somebody who is. So, give me a break. When you support someone who is an active racist, like Trump is, then de facto you are. I'm sorry. You know, it's like, oh, the people who voted for George Wallace, they weren't racist. But he was, but they supported him anyway because they liked his politics.
Gail writes to us and says that black people wanted to get revenge. Wouldn't it have happened within the 400 years we have been here? We are seeking equality, and dismantling systemic racism would be a start. Nobody? Denise says, while racism is certainly a big part of Trump's appeal in his base, don't underestimate the right's hatred for liberals. They are thrilled by how Trump infuriates and horrifies liberals. The level of division in this country is truly frightening. Barbara on the race issue, why is his base unmovable? I've been saying this for 5 years. It's pretty simple. He hates the same people they hate.
Right.
Wayne says, in response to why so many still support Trump, I've been noticing lately there are a lot of folks who are out there who support the idea. Well, I read that earlier. I apologize. Lynn says, just my two cents, but I think Trump's appeal is racism, yes. But I think that racism is animated, as all scapegoating is, by the underlying fear brought about by the real losses that have come to Americans generally over the last decade or two. Survival fear, looking for an answer, finds a scapegoat in blacks. Janice says, every day the panel discusses how awful this administration is. What can ordinary citizens do now other than hope? I also read that one. Where is my, I apologize for my not deleting enough here. Paul says, good morning, panel. I can't actually fathom that we are having a national fight over supporting our post office, but here we are. The president and Republicans have not figured out yet that they are overmatched when it comes to Nancy Pelosi. She is much better at this than they are, and I suspect her strategy will work in the end. Anything on that, Alan?
No, I think that's right. Look, she's calling the House of Representatives back because she knows how unpopular this anti-post office move on the part of Trump is. And by creating this this diversion or whatever he's doing, or for whatever reason he's doing it, he has, in fact, energized an awful lot of people. Nancy Pelosi, of course, is very, very bright, and she does what she has to do. She brings them back. To do anything else would have been criminal. You have to bring them back. It has to be answered.
Katie says, I'm just wondering about Trump's comments regarding obstruction of the Postal Service because he knows it will affect the November election. How is that not an impeachable offense.
It's only impeachable if the Senate will vote for it, and they won't.
Sid says, hypothetical question regarding the Postmaster General's actions. Could a state's governor declare an emergency if voting is being jeopardized due to the Postmaster General's slow down policies? Call out the National Guard to assist in any way? Would such a move be possible? Legal? Question mark. I realize there is a postal workers union to consider. I don't know the answer to that. I don't know if anyone on the panel would know the answer to that, but it's an interesting scenario to think of. Beverly says, Trump is saying, I am going to lie and cheat right in front of your face, and there is nothing you can do about it. Wake up, people. Our democracy is at stake. That is from Beverly. Okay, let's go to some other items here and see what else we have on our docket. Of course, the Democratic Convention is tonight. It will juggle hundreds of live feeds to recreate the feel of a party celebration. We should mention that we will be airing coverage of the Democratic National Convention tonight, as we will be the Republican National Convention next week, through NPR tonight beginning at 9 o'clock. Faced with a complex problem, Democrats decided to go big, aiming for a solution that has more in common with Netflix, Facebook Live, and the cheering fan screens courtside in Orlando's NBA bubble than the C-SPAN-style cattle call typical of past National Party gatherings. Over four nights starting tonight, a behind-the-scenes crew of about 400 with operation centers in New York, Milwaukee, Los Angeles, and Wilmington plan to broadcast to the nation hundreds of live video feeds from living rooms, national monuments, and stages around the country, according to interviews with three people involved planning that event. We should also note that Governor Cuomo will be speaking tonight. He is one of the featured speakers, so has a primetime slot for on the convention for tonight. The convention,
like his father.
That's right.
And frankly, Joe, he's earned it.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
I mean, you take a look at who's out front for the Democrats in the midst of this horrible situation. It's been Cuomo. He deserves it.
Mr. Biden will speak on Thursday, marking the beginning of a formal general election between Mr. Biden and President Trump. Kamala Harris will have her largest audience yet in a speech on Wednesday evening, and a who's who of Democratic Party politics will also deliver addresses to the nation, including President Barack Obama, former First Lady Michelle Obama, Senator Bernie Sanders, and Hillary and Bill Clinton. All right, Alan, what do you think?
I think it's going to be a good show. You know, I've never been terribly impressed by the conventions and all the hoopla. It's just one more circus, which is diversionary in so many ways, from keeping your eye on the prize. And, you know, there'll be a bump for the Democrats. They'll get some bump out of this. And then the Republicans will come on. They'll get some bump, too. You know, I think it's unfortunate for the American people that they can't have their circus, but they can't.
Libby?
I think it's going to be very interesting to watch. It's going to be nothing like we've ever experienced before. Much shorter speeches, 2 hours, you know, on C-SPAN or on the cable, and 1 hour on network. You know, and supposedly there's going to be interaction with folks, with delegates at their gathering places or in their homes. I'm looking forward to it just from a technological point of view. I want to see how well it gets done. But I do think that we'll get a bump, and the Republicans will get their bump. You know, I remember when John McCain got a massive bump after Sarah Palin, and then everything went down, down. That's all I can say. Everything went down from there. And so, you know, the same thing will happen, and then we'll get down to the business of campaigning. And I do think that, you know, we've got census takers now going around door to door, and they're practicing social distancing, and they're wearing masks. I do think that it's possible to do door to door work during this upcoming campaign if we do it responsibly. And, you know, in some of the communities that need to have folks brought out. It's a different way of campaigning. There'll be much more online than there ever has been, and there's been a lot of it, and a lot of, you know, on TV and advertising and all that. But I think we might start to see some people using some shoe leather.
Sarah?
I'm excited for the music. I know that's like really shallow, but
yeah. Who's doing the halftime show this year during the convention? Do we know?
I mean, I get geeked up for these things anyway, but I don't. And I know that in the past they've had music, but I think like people miss their music in the pandemic, and we're gonna see artists that. Go ahead.
Maybe they'll have Randy Rainbow. You know, maybe Rainbow will come. That would be great.
Maybe. I'm always excited for the speeches. I'm distressed that AOC has exactly 1 minute of the floor, because I think she's the voice of the generation of folks that they really need to get to. Should be a great show.
And Jennifer.
Yeah, I agree too. And I think AOC being there is so important, because when we're looking at the Clintons, right, for younger voters, they seem, and this is not to be mean to them, but like a relic of the past, mm-hmm. right? I mean, Hillary Clinton is historic for her running. So this is also going to be an interesting dynamic too, as she's speaking there, because she obviously lost the last presidential election against Trump. But, you know, the younger generation, I don't know how much they are interested in watching some of these older, I don't say older folks, but you know what I mean? There's a disconnect there a little bit. So AOC brings that progressive, tone. And I think that's really important.
Yeah, it's a good point, because if you think of the list that I read, yes, definitely skews older, to say the least.
Mm-hmm. And maybe, you know, that's, you know, part of what Biden's really got to look at, getting to those moderates and getting to the older voters who we know turn out more than a lot of younger voters do. But the younger voters really matter right now. I mean, they're the future of this change. So they have to be excited and they have to be drawn in. And maybe it being shorter will do that, because, you know, we have to, you know, remember that these conventions sometimes went on for a really long time before. So now keeping it short and sweet is a good thing.
Yeah, I agree with that. Yeah. All right, let's go to another subject if we can, and talk about the coronavirus. Interesting article in the New York Times this morning that notes, of course, there is no vaccine for COVID-19, but there is one for influenza, with the season's first doses now shipping. Officials are struggling over how to get people to take it. Even a mild flu season could stagger hospitals already coping with COVID-19 cases. And though officials don't know yet what degree of severity to anticipate this year, they are worried large numbers of people could forego flu shots, increasing the risk of widespread outbreaks. The concern about what's being called a twindemic is so great that officials around the world are pushing the flu shot even before it becomes available in clinics and doctors' offices. Dr. Robert Redfield, director of the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, has been talking it up, urging corporate leaders to figure out ways to inoculate employees. The CDC usually purchases 500,000 doses for uninsured adults. This year, they ordered an additional 9.3 million doses. Dr. Anthony Fauci, director of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases, has been imploring people to get the flu shot so that you could at least blunt the effect of one of those two potential respiratory infections. So in an age when we are trying to get people to put a covering over their face, how willing will many, many people be to go to a pharmacy or a doctor's office or even to the cubicle down the hall to get their seasonal flu shot?
Well, you know, the governor of New Jersey, Phil Murphy, said people who don't take the shot when it's available for the big disease, for the coronavirus, are knuckleheads. Who don't wear the mask are knuckleheads. That's right, they are. And there will be knuckleheads when it comes to taking the taking the shots. I go and I get a shot every year at my pharmacy. The only thing is, I wonder whether they're going to be ready to do that. And one other thing that bothers me is how the people who do the flu injections basically haven't gotten it right a couple of times. In other words, they put the wrong ingredients in, which creates you can get the shot, but it won't help you.
Right.
Well, no vaccine, no flu vaccine is going to be 100%. It's just,
I'm not talking 100%.
It's just the way it is.
Yeah,
they're never 100%.
I'm not talking 100%. I'm talking about seriously, they missed the boat. And there've been a lot of studies on that.
Well, let's not turn that into vaccines suck.
I agree with
because,
you. I just got through saying I did it.
I mean, right, I know. Because there are plenty of anti-vaxxers out there who are not going to avail themselves of a COVID-19 vaccination when it does come out and will not get a flu shot. I'll be going and getting a flu shot. I get one every year. And I have not gotten the flu in quite a while. And I got the flu once when I had the flu shot. And it just goes to show, it doesn't cover everything, but it covers a lot.
Anyone else on the flu vaccination? I mean, that idea of a twindemic is scary, especially since we don't know what what coronavirus is going to do or can do as far as the fall and coming back.
Well, and what if you get both?
Right.
The flu is ultimately a respiratory infection.
Besides really bad luck, it's really horrible.
How will you know? How will you know what you got?
That's right. Yeah.
And thinking about how this is going to impact, you know, the hospitals and doctor's offices and all those things when people want to get in for the shot or do have the sniffles, plus COVID testing and everything else, it creates a major roadblock here, just a traffic jam, and it's very, very scary.
We have about 3 or 4 minutes before we go over to news at the bottom of the hour and have time for a few letters. Jen says the defensive white men who are acting up don't understand that they've been the American top 40 for over 200 years and it's time for them to take their place in the shuffle. Why are they ticked off? It's hard to see anything but loss when you're at the top. It's not personal, but we're sick of their song, even if there's no getting rid of it. Edie says Trump campaign will spend the most to date on ads on every social media forum tonight. That is apparently true from what we have heard from the published reports. Ryan says, so if Libby believes that everyone is racist, then how are you guys standing so strong with Joe Biden? Early in his career, he was a big supporter of Robert Byrd. He is quoted as saying he does not want his children in a jungle. What they are talking about integration in the schools. So you're replacing one racist with another.
Libby's not the only one. This is Sarah, and I'm the one who said that everybody's racist because that all white people are racist, and some people who are not white. Libby, I know you want to get in there, and this is directed at you, but I just want to say I'm not going to defend anything that Joe Biden has done in the past that's been racist, or anyone else for that matter. But what I will do is hold leaders accountable and hold myself accountable for becoming anti-racist as we move into what we come to understand that to mean. And someone like Joe Biden can learn from his mistakes, and he's trying to show that he has. So I'll leave it at that.
Libby?
All I was going to say was that people have the ability to change. You know, I know my parents, my father was pretty homophobic, and I came out, and he changed. He wasn't perfect, but he changed. People have the ability to change, and we have to recognize that. And when white people do the work that needs to be done to deal with internalized racism and what that means to their neighbors and friends, then you have to honor that. And I think Biden recognizes that things have changed. And, you know, he was friends with Byrd when Byrd was in Congress and the Senate, you know, in the 80s and the 90s. And so it's 40 years ago. We all have the ability to learn.
Well, and isn't this interesting? Because this is one of the things that Kamala Harris called him out on. right early on when they were debating each other for presidential nominations, when she was saying, you know, busing was opposed, right? So I didn't get to take a school bus, or they wouldn't do school busing.
Right.
Right. And so I think, you know, sometimes when you have that kind of thing front and center in your face, and now you can reflect back on how those policies have had the outcome they have had, that's where some of that change can happen, right? I mean, you can't always change immediately today because somebody says it. Is Joe Biden perfect? In my opinion, no. No. But with certain people around him, there can be policies and things that are changed that help. And that's really, I think, the key.
Just real quick before we go over to the break, and this is for you, Sarah. Marianne wrote to us and says, performers listed so far for the convention, John Legend, Billie Eilish, Jennifer Hudson, Billy Porter, Leon Bridges, and Common. So there you go. Great music.
Yeah.
All right. We're going to take a break. When we come back, we have to say goodbye to Libby because she has to run. In fact, I think she already did run, but we'll be back right after this short break and continue on WAMC. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. Alan Chartok, Jennifer Burns, and Sarah Rogerson still with us this morning. We welcome your letters panel at WAMC.org. Quick programming note that we will be taking the briefing and announcement that Governor Andrew Cuomo will be making from New York City at 11:30 this morning, and we'll be going to that live as soon as it begins, somewhere around 11:30. Let's do this story. It's one in the New York Times, and I had to read it a couple of times to make sure I understood it, and unfortunately I did. A private security company is detaining migrant children at hotels. Under emergency coronavirus orders, the Trump administration is using hotels across the country to hold migrant children and families before expelling them. Government data obtained by the New York Times, along with court documents, show that hotel detentions overseen by a private security company have ballooned in recent months under an aggressive border closure policy related to the coronavirus pandemic. More than 100,000 migrants, including children and families, have been summarily expelled from the country under the measure, but rather than deterring additional migration, the policy appears to have caused border crossings to surge, in part because it eliminates some of the legal consequences for repeat attempts at illegal crossings. The increase in hotel detention is likely to intensify scrutiny of the policy, which legal advocacy groups have already challenged in court, saying it places children in an opaque system with few protections and violates U.S. asylum laws by returning them to life-threatening situations in their home countries. So, Sarah, this is your world. Tell us a little bit about what is going on and your thoughts on it.
Yeah, I'm eternally grateful for reporters like Caitlin Dickerson at the New York Times who have really put in a lot of work to understand the nuances of immigration law. And I just want to note up front, there's a lot that's packed into your summary there, right? What we're ultimately talking about is the Trump administration using the pandemic to shut down lawful avenues for border crossings, including asylum seekers, right? And to continue to separate families under a cloak of public-private partnerships. You see a number of chain hotels who are distancing themselves from this, saying we are a franchise-based company and we're going to have to work with our franchisees to let them know that we won't allow this kind of practice to happen. But another troubling piece that Caitlin mentioned in there is that these hotels are also not being regulated according to DHS's own regulations or the Flores settlement regarding the conditions of detention for minors. That should upset everybody because we're talking about basic minimum standards of care, such as where people get food. Another issue highlighted is the Prison Rape Elimination Act, or PREA, whether or not these makeshift detention facilities need to follow federal law regarding how people are housed and their rights and who they report suspected sexual assault. And right now, the way it's set up, the only way that a guard can report an incident of sexual assault against a minor child in these detained settings, separated from their parents, is to report it to another guard. So that's not PREA compliance by any stretch of the imagination. So many issues, so many problems. Immigration lawyers continuing to sue left and right, and just a tidal wave onslaught against our immigration system as we know it. It continues to happen, wave upon wave, every other day.
I apologize for being dense on the subject, or not being naive on it, at least. And that is the hotels, of sending the children to hotels. How is this different from the camps that had been set up? Is this a different, under a different program, or is it? I mean, there's nothing good about this, but I'm saying, is that somewhat of an improvement than what the conditions that they had been in?
Well, we don't know because they won't tell us.
Right. Okay.
People are trying to shine light on what's going on in those hotels. We don't know. We have to trust that these businesses don't want any sort of damage to their property. So
right.
Presumably there are some minimum standards, but we don't know. And you're not dense. This is complicated stuff. The hotels are housing overflow folks from this rapid deportation program. And what's happening is they just can't deport people fast enough. So this housing is meant to be even more temporary than the minor child settings that are meant to be more long term. Although they're not supposed to exceed 90 days, I think it is. I'd have to go and double check my Flores knowledge. But it's not meant to, even in those longer term settings, the detention of children is not supposed to last beyond a certain time period. So there are a multitude of laws, consent decrees, and governmental regulations that are part of these lawsuits. It's everything from the Administrative Procedure Act on down.
Alan?
Well, it's interesting because everything Sarah says is profound and correct. Remember how much play this incredibly bad situation was given in this country.
Right.
People really gave a damn. Sarah, I'd love your impression on whether or not that has changed and why.
We're certainly not seeing the money flowing to the organizations that went there when all of this broke in the summer of 2018. And we're not seeing as many news stories on the front page because the Trump administration is very gifted at making sure that they know what's going to be above the fold every day. They make the news. And as try as they might, the news agencies, but many are keeping shining a light on this. You follow folks like The Intercept. As I mentioned, Caitlin Dickerson, The New York Times does a great job covering this stuff. But I think we're tired as Americans of the onslaught of negative attacks on everything that we care about. And it's hard to maintain focus on anyone.
Well, and the pandemic, right? I mean, the pandemic was a huge, even this particular program, as I mentioned, program meaning what they're doing with the children in the hotels, was at least the excuse given was coronavirus.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, well, I mean, they're using that to cover all sorts of human rights abuses.
Right.
And those just, it's going to take time and reporting and piecing the putting the pieces back together. But yeah, I mean, everyone should know that right now there are children that are suffering, that are scared and lonely, and we don't know how they're being treated by our government right now.
Well, not only that, because I have a question about the difference between deportation and expulsion. I mean, I know that both of them mean you're removed from the country, but this expulsion is kind of like we just put you on planes and fly you and leave you, right? So you don't have to go through the
paperwork. There's no hearing. Yep.
Right. And that's even scarier, too, because for children or the adults that are being, flown elsewhere and left, what hands do they fall into when they arrive back into their home country? What happens to them, too, after that? That is so frightening.
Mm. Yeah, and what we're getting initial reports from the ACLU is that they're essentially being handed into the arms of traffickers, human traffickers.
Oh, yeah. And who's going to track that down, and who's going to find these children later after they're gone in the wind? I mean, it's horrifying.
Absolutely.
Well, and, I was in the New York Times article. The other thing I found interesting is that they're testing for coronavirus, right? They're saying either in the detention centers or in the hotels that are the shadow detention centers, I guess we'll say, right? They're and for children who test positive, they quarantine them. So my question is, where are they doing that, and what's the treatment like there? But for adults who are tested positive, they immediately expel them. So that means they're high risk to spread, right, the virus in every route they take to get back to their home country. So in some ways, this system is supporting the spread of the pandemic.
Yeah, not a doubt. And okay. No, there are federal lawsuits currently pending about the spread of COVID inside detention facilities, the lack of appropriate PPE, the lack of appropriate social distancing. Immigration lawyers nationwide have won lawsuits to get groups of people out of detention on account of the pandemic. That's litigation that's winding its way through federal courts as we speak, because litigators have identified an opportunity in the pandemic to make additional arguments for why people should not be stuck in these hot boxes of contagion.
Mm.
It's essentially a death sentence for some people to keep them there. And then, add this to the pile. They're no longer keeping track of serial numbers for kids and whose parents they belong to or which grownups they belong to. So we're going to see this is going to be a legacy of family separation for years and decades to come, where we will hear these heart-wrenching human interest stories down the road on NPR about, I was separated from my parents at the border and I just found them, as a 50-year-old person. It's just terrible.
It is terrible. We have just about 2 minutes left. We have a couple of letters. Let me get to those, and a reminder that we have the governor coming up at 11:30 this morning. Tony writes, this is on the flu shot. We are 75 and 81. We always get the yearly flu shot for decades. We never get sick, knock on wood, for decades. We know that does not mean COVID-19 cannot kill us. We take all precautions. Then we go to this one. Let's see here. I'm having trouble. Please wait while the operator.
standing by.
Oh, Marty was asking, and I think you touched on this. I think you were touching on this earlier, Sarah, but about I'm interested to know which hotels are complicit. So we don't know because it's, as you said, it's franchisees, right?
Right. I mean, we know the names of some of the hotels. I believe the Hampton Inn.
Yes.
If you look in the story in the New York Times today, they have little flags all over the country from Florida to SeaTac in Washington. I think there's a Quality Inn up in Washington State, and you can see all of these. They're what would be called in the travel industry, budget hotels or travel lodges, essentially. If any of you have had to stay in one of those, I have a lot of questions about the quality of those rooms just for regular customers.
So talk about, as you said, the maps, and we only have about a minute and a half, but talk about the flags on the maps, that these hotels are all over the country. So how does that, for want of a better term, that distribution system work?
Oh, you never know. I mean, we've got, that's how we ended up with 350 folks from the border in Albany County Jail. We're still trying to figure out how that happened. We have been denied a FOIA request to figure out the decision-making process that went into that. You have no idea. They put people on planes overnight. You have no idea where you're going.
So they could show up here, they could show up anywhere in our region.
Yeah, they're probably not coming back here. We showed that people will get access to lawyers and will get out of jail quickly if they bring them here.
Well, kudos for that. We are out of time. I thank everybody for being with us. Alan, thank you so much. Always a pleasure. Thanks to Jennifer Burns and Sarah Rogerson, and of course for Libby Post, who did have to leave a few minutes early. Thank you all. We'll be back with the Congressional Corner right after this.